trusty money remains the bedrock of stability. The soul of money is trust.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences.
In the immortal words of the Doors, the time to hesitate is through.
So, Pete Wynn from Fetty, what's going on?
Oh, just getting some work done and then stopping for a quick podcast chat. So,
God bless. I appreciate you taking the time and spending the energy to do it, man. Thank you very much. How did you discover Bitcoin?
I was thinking about this. It's probably like two answers, right? There's the how did I discover Bitcoin, and then the how did I discover that it should be just Bitcoin, which are maybe a few months apart, the two of them, maybe probably about 6 months, I think, to take that journey. But it was 2017. I was working on a startup which was based in the payment space. And so what we were doing was with a payment app, mobile payments. But then the fees that you were paying, we took those fees. Instead of it going to a bank, we paid it into like a charity project. So we were building schools over in Cambodia. And then inside the app, you get this nice like impact story about like, you know, here's the coffee that you had. Here's the school that's being built. Here's the kids going into the school. Here's lives being changed. And then you just, it's like, my God, I can't pay with anything else. This is amazing. And that was the idea. And as we were building that out, I had a friend who's formerly into Bitcoin from a few years before. And he came to me and he was like, Pete, you should be using Bitcoin. And I was like, no, this doesn't make any sense. That's just going to add friction to the payment. Why would I look at that? And then I thought, well, maybe there's something there in the auditing space around how you can track the payments. Because that'll be a bit of a pain if we get big, which we never did, unfortunately. And so I started looking into blockchains. Mm-hmm. No, I came at that I wasn't that interested in the monetary aspect. I just thought, this could be quite a neat way of automating auditing and systems, which probably is, frankly. But and then I don't know. I started to get into it, and it was 2017, and everything was going crazy. And I bought a bit of Bitcoin and some Ethereum and shitcoin. And then everything started going up, and then you get really interested in things that are going up all of a sudden. And I started following that. I did the Oxford University's inaugural blockchain program, which was like Melton shilling people shitcoins.
it is remarkable the level of interest maps the trajectory as it goes up, and you think, oh, I'm winning here. This is great. What am I actually winning at, though?
Yeah, well, I think that's it. And then I started to look into it a bit more, and when I was looking at how I could implement various blockchains with the payment app that we were working in, I just didn't really see what the point of a lot of them was. And so then I started to listen to more podcasts, and this is now probably the second answer to the question is why just Bitcoin? Was when I was listening to Marty Bent on Tales from the Crypt quite a bit. And he just kept saying the word sound money. I remember walking out the gate at the back of the yard one day and just thinking, like, why don't I know what that is? You know, like I'm 35 or wherever I would have been at the time. Like, it's, you know, why would I be in like this old and not know what those words mean? Because the alternative to that is unsound money.
Sure.
And I don't think I want that, but that sounds like that's what I've got. So I need to figure this out. And then I started looking into like, well, what is sound money? And then that was like how I orange pilled myself. And I think there is an element. I don't think you ever orange pill other people. I think the best you've got is that you can incept a question into them that gets them to orange pill themselves. And I think that was it for me. It was like sound money. Well, I don't want unsound money.
That's such a good point.
Yeah. I always ask people, like, if someone said, okay, you need to get up on the roof, got some jobs to do, we're going to use a ladder, I've got two ladders, I've got a safe ladder and an unsafe ladder. You'd be like, oh, I'll go the safe ladder. That sounds brilliant. Like, why would I want the
this one's had every second or third rung removed. This one has all of the rungs.
Yeah. This one just moves about. It's made of jelly. Do you want the jelly ladder?
Yeah.
It's like, got a ladder. It sounds good.
That's a really cool analogy, actually. And the fact that you effectively incentivized yourself to orange pill yourself, you know, you'd already bought, you bought in, and then, you know, that kind of incentivized you to look a little bit deeper. But then this word, this term, sound money, you're right, like, because the opposite is unsound money. So that would imply that it's the negative. And what is this thing? So how long before you came back through the gate had you kind of figured it out? How long did it take?
Oh, I don't know. That was just the start of like quite a deep rabbit hole, right? So I'm still going down that today. But it was probably like within a month or two, I was like, yeah, I don't see the point in anything except Bitcoin. Certainly in terms of like where the material impact is going to be. You know, like I sort of think it's a slightly weak argument to say there's no use cases for blockchain. It's like, well, you know, it's just a quick way of verifying stuff. Like that's fine. It's a data structure. It's fine. Like I don't have anything against blockchains, but it's just slightly immaterial to the change you could have on the world by through the sound money. And so it's like, yeah, I think this is the answer.
Interesting. Right.
There's probably one other element to it as well, which was that I started to look again, like looking at like how you would implement things on Ethereum. I was trying to figure out, you know, why would I use this and this particular consensus mechanism versus all the other options that are available. And I think when you start to look at the whole thing, you start to realize like how much of it is just marketing spin, and the properties that are being sold to you don't really exist. Like when you like look at what it would take to implement like that sort of consensus system, you realize that, you know, it doesn't have the same level of proof of work. It doesn't have the same, you know, like link back into the real world, or there's some sort of reliance on centralized parties. And I don't know, I didn't like it. And I always equate the Ethereum approach to being a bit like sticking everything in one database. So there's like, so I've done a lot of work in sort of IT and resources companies, obviously over here in WA, where if you go work for an oil and gas company, and anybody that's done this will have a story a bit like this, where there'll be one guy who thinks the way that you solve all the problems is that we just take all of the production data, like from the wells, and we take all of the planning data, and we take all of the exploration data, and we take all of the, you know, maintenance history and data there, and we just put it all into this one big database, and we'll be able to do whatever we want. And it works in the pilot, and then you blow $100 million trying to do it in real life, and it doesn't scale. It never does. It's just too much. You got no knowledge of what's going on. You just sort of try to cram everything into one box. This happens quite a lot. I feel like that's what Ethereum tries to do. Is it just says, oh, let's just ignore all of the compromises or good design principles that we might need. They just put everything into a blockchain, and then it might work. And it kind of works at a very like low proof of concept type level of like, oh yeah, I can do some stuff. But then it's just never going to scale. You don't want global state on something like that. And so I kind of then just brushed that off and went, okay, I can see how I would build similar things with Bitcoin. So I assume it'll take a few years for that to happen, but that's where it'll end up, because that's a better design. It's pulled apart a bit. It's designed in layers. It's designed in the right way. So, yeah, so I think that sort of technical thinking helped guide me as well. So there was the, like, I want sound money, not unsound money. And then there was, yeah, this is just how you would design it. It's being done better on Bitcoin. That's just a dumpster fire. That's not going to go anywhere. Surrounded by hype and nonsense.
So you were drawing on your experience in IT and building out databases in that respect, and then filtering this new discovery, so to speak, with that experience behind you. Is the is that thing about you talking about trying to put everything into a database, is it because once all of that data is in there, it's very difficult for them to get to them to talk to one another, to interoperate and be, you know, seamless in a way? Or is it something else?
It's usually more of like a bastardization of the governance structure. So in, this is probably a bit more low-level information architecture type stuff, but, you know, like data and processes and like maps to real-world stuff, and it has owners and a reality around it of what's going on. When you just try and like merge everything into one big system, you kind of lose a lot of that, and like who owns stuff becomes unclear, like how you update things, how you map between different points of view on a subject. Like you just, you bring a lot of complexity into the system that you really don't need. Like you don't need everything to be integrated at this really low level like a computer system. You're usually much better off keeping the systems apart, figuring out like the few touch points that you need to talk to, and then doing like a higher level, like more loosely coupled sort of thing. So it's,
So it's a bit like how Bitcoin is designed, where you've got the layer one protocol, and then we're now building, and I say we very loosely and not a socialist term at all, but there are people building wonderful things on top of this, this base layer protocol, which will clean up a lot of that complexity that you're describing that Ethereum suffers from, or those sorts of things suffer from.
So if you drew it to Bitcoin, you might say like the first layer is really about security. It's just, we want money, so let's just have a first thing, let's make sure nobody can take it. That's what we're really optimizing for in that layer. And then because it was one layer system at the start, we'll also add in how can we move it about so we can transact in a few different ways of holding it. So some like low level structures for contracting. But really the optimization is all about make sure nobody can steal this, whether that's like the state through inflation or your neighbor through a gun to your head. And that's what it does really well at that level. And then the next level was like, okay, it's a bit of a pain in the ass moving it around. So we're going to need to solve that. All right, well, that's sort of Lightning and various other ways of just speeding up the settlement assurances. So let's take like a point in time, create a channel out of that, and then in that channel we can settle deterministically at any point that we need to. So once you've got that like, little anchor in the blockchain, then all of a sudden you can do instant settlement. You can go backwards and forwards. You can, you know, settle stuff instantly. That solves speed at that next level. And then I think you just end up with different systems that will solve different things. So, you know, things like DLCs or to a certain extent, Fedimints help with things like contract execution. So yeah, we will want sort of smart contracts in a way, but you don't want them built in the money. Like that's just weird. Like, you know, it's like the Ethereum guys, I always go back to Ethereum because it's just the main shitcoin, but it's, you know, you have this notion of they'll take the meme and then get it wrong. It's like they go, oh, horse and carriage, and then they put the horse like behind the carriage, giving it a push. And like, no, guys, it's like you didn't listen. It's like, and they go, programmable money, great. We'll put the programs in the money, and you're like, no, it's wrong. You put the money in the program, and that's how you would do it. That makes sense. What are you trying to do? Or they go, all right, we need like oracles and on-chain data. We're going to put all of the internet. We're going to put all the internet in the money, like in the blockchain. You're like, don't do that. That's insane. Just put the money in the network. Like, don't put the network in the money. It doesn't make any sense. You're just backwards. So they're completely, as we'd say in England, arse about tit on the whole thing. They just don't.
Do you have any insight in like other aspects of where you've worked and what you've applied your skills and expertise to that sort of way of thinking? Like there are obviously people out there that do think like that, yeah, cool, let's put the cart before the horse, like literally, and we'll figure out any kind of issues that crop up along the way. We'll figure it out. You know, it's such fuzzy thinking.
I think it's like, if you want to, it depends on like how you're approaching the problems, right? Because you can solve problems quickly or you can solve them right. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the Ethereum approach is that they just constantly try and do the quick shit version of the thing. So maybe it helps. Like, I started my career over in Rolls Royce, like working in their like defense aerospace, like engine departments on Eurofighters and stuff like that. And it was very like quality based system to get anything done. So that might have affected me a little bit, and just an approach where I feel like you should do it correctly because that's going to actually work when you want to go and deploy it. Whereas, yeah, it just feels like a cheat. Like it would be like, when I was little, I used to get these Action Replay cartridges that you could sit in like a game console or something. And it just gave you like God mode on all the games.
Yep.
And you go, oh, this is fantastic. I can do all this stuff. And then like 5 minutes later, you just don't want to play any of them anymore because there's no challenge to it.
Yeah, yeah. I used to do that with Doom. And
yeah,
just completely, yep, fun for, you know, 10 minutes and then bored.
And I feel like it's a bit like that. It's just like trying to take the quick, cheaty version of doing something where you just go, all right, well, I'll just stick everything in this same database. I'll stick everything in. It's like cooking a meal in a trough. It's like everything in a trough. Like, it's cool. It's there. Like, everything's there. Like, what are you talking about?
It's a crock pot.
Yeah.
Which is a crock. So there you are. I'm curious to learn then, given all of that, why do you think that you are open and able to discovering Bitcoin?
I think that technical background was part of it. It was enough to then question a lot of the, like, particularly 2017, it was very like hard on the glossy marketing of all of the bullshit chains. And you don't know at that point, I think, who to follow. So I think there was definitely an element of figuring out that, okay, well, most of this was nonsense. And then I think I got down to like, okay, well, maybe Ethereum is useful. And then I think it was probably like Hyperledger that got me out of it. So I was like, well, why wouldn't I just use, if I've got like orchestration work, I can just use that. And then I could send Bitcoin based on the outputs of that stuff, and that's fine. And then I don't have to deal with all the overhead of running Ethereum and paying gas fees and nonsense like that. And so I thought, well, I just don't, at that point, I didn't really see the point of it. And then I started digging more into like technically how you achieve like DLCs and smart contracts on Ethereum. I had a few of my own ideas about how you could do that in Lightning Network. And I think at that point I was like, no, this is just going to get solved in Bitcoin. So we're better off. Like we want the money. We want the sound money, not the unsound money, which is as unsound as they come when you look at the policy on it. So I think it's just that. It was just questioning it. But.
And that's obviously to do with your background. If you're working in to the capacity that you were at Rolls Royce and building out the sorts of infrastructure that requires, it's a very deliberate, mindful, step-by-step pursuit of quality, I suppose. And then that kind of has led you into to that mode of thinking. So you're almost predisposed to it, I guess. Fuck, I had a question in my head and now I can't remember it. what was it? It was something to do with Ethereum. It's gone.
Why is it shit?
No, yeah.
I mean, I don't think it'll exist in 10 years.
No.
I think all the use cases will be gone. I learned this discussion in Riga quite a lot when I was over at the Baltic Honey Badger conference. And I always say like this, I've only got two problems with Ethereum, and it's just the frauds and the nonsense.
Right.
Beyond that, like it's fine. It's just that it's mostly frauds and nonsense.
So frauds
just
and nonsense couched in a great sea platform of noise.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great platform for just launching fraud and enabling that, which is bad. We don't need more fraud in society.
No, we already have that in the with the fiat monetary system. That's perfect.
Exactly. We've got a whole banking system.
That's lovely. Works so beautifully.
I guess in a way, maybe it's nice that we've democratized fraud, but that wasn't like a grand ambition that I had in life.
Perhaps. It's one way of thinking about it. We've made fraud accessible to the common man. We can digitize the snake oil salesman, the new frontier of the 21st century.
And then the other one was the nonsense was just that realization that it's kind of been built wrong. It's just not how you would want this. If you want it to be scalable and private, which I think we all do, then you build it in a manner where it's completely off chain. You don't have a global state system that has to do it. Yeah.
When you were trying to discern what sound money is, I dare say you'd never even thought about monetary history and economics maybe more generally, certainly maybe in more of an Austrian view. I certainly hadn't. But how deep down that rabbit hole and those tunnels did you need to dig in order to then come back up and then be able to combine these two fields that you've prior experience and now this new discovery that you've found?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's uncommon that I like went off and read a whole bunch of Austrian economics books because everybody was talking about those. I'd followed a lot more macro and economics talk, just trying to understand what's going on in the world with bonds and stuff like that. I mean, I found particularly around like the start of COVID, like the overreaction period, maybe we'll call it. There was this whole, like the news was just so bad, you couldn't figure out what to do. And I kind of stopped watching telly and news as much as I could years ago. I stopped in the UK and then I moved to Australia, like turned on the telly and I was like, fuck this. Just took it out of the wall. There's no point. It's terrible over here. And so I wasn't getting that much. But then all of a sudden, like all the like Twitter news feeds and things like that weren't quite as good as they were. And I found that just you could listen to like macro voices, something like that. And it would just, you could use it as news because it was just, like, they don't care. Like it's one of the few areas where they really don't care about the politics. But they'll just go, well, this could happen. This could happen. This is what seems to be happening. And this is probably what effect it's going to have on the world. And you feel like, oh, great. Like I'm getting like all the news and what's going on, but with none of the shit around it, with all the nonsense politics that's just a bit of a scam. But
yeah, I reckon Eric Townsend's Macro Voices is one of the best podcasts, but it's like listening to, I mean, whenever he sort of, you know, glances where you know that Bitcoin can just fit into that and that's the problem solved, Eric, like sorted.
Yeah.
It's sometimes one of the most infuriating things to listen to because it's like listening to the smartest, dumbest people in the room.
Yes.
And like, yeah, I'm stupid and I'm a moron, but like you just know that you've got this piece of the puzzle that could just kind of, if you would just open your mind, Eric, we could fit this in quite neatly. And
it's curious, right? Because it's similar with like Mike Green or Jeff Snyder and people like that. They're really good and they're really sharp and and all the stuff they've said, they've never made me think that the answer wasn't Bitcoin.
Mm.
It's like, even when they're bashing Bitcoin, it all seems a bit, it's sort of like low grade FUD, but you kind of think, okay, well in every other aspect of how they describe society, I just think, yeah, like that's a society in which I would prefer to own Bitcoin than not. So I'm still tracking. So I find stuff like that like a nice out of the echo chamber sort of view of the world that helps reassess, like, okay, well, am I correct in thinking that this is the way to go and this is probably like the one asset you do want to hold, but of course,
also those particular podcasts I personally found quite useful in the fact that compared to TV and radio, it's so pacey and it's just foam, really. It's just crests of foam. Whereas when you listen to the podcasts, you get more of the energy underneath the wave. So you kind of get to understand how this wave is formed as opposed to just the froth and the crashing of all of this stuff on top, which is what nightly news concentrates on, and you get no signal from that whatsoever. You just get angry and emotive and ask for somebody else to fix it, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what a lot of media is designed for, right? Whereas with these podcasts, you've got people that are going, right, well, I want to figure out the best place to leave my money. And so it's very obvious like what their bias is and what they care about is, well, how do I stay rich?
Yes.
It's fine. I can take that at face value. But now I can use you for news because you have to figure out the news and what's going on in order to do that. But, yeah, it's interesting that you get some ways like a clearer view of stuff. But
yeah.
Obviously, it would be interesting when they finally come around to Bitcoin. But you wonder if they ever will.
We wait. We wait with bated breath. I'm not going to hold it, but we'll wait with bated breath. How has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
Yeah, I mean, it probably certainly has. Like, this is a better question for, like, I don't know, like the wives of Bitcoin. there's some obvious stuff around, like, it's changed, like, how I do, like, what I do for work now and what I worry about. Maybe some of the time preference stuff. Like there's something about knowing you go through like a period of stacking some sats and you're like, all right, so I'll probably be okay in like 20 years or I'll probably be okay in like 10 years, depending on how well you can stack. Yeah, like that takes a bit of the pressure off of just that constant worry of like, fuck, like what do I do when I retire and I'm old? Stuff like that. So it's kind of nice to have that put away, and then to like have some for your kids and just be like, oh, I'll buy you 100,000 sats and that'll probably like buy your first house by the time you get it. It's gonna be like 20 years away. But so I mean, it's, yeah, it gives me a little bit more security and certainty around the future. And I don't know, I just became obsessed by it, frankly. Like I think over time I just felt that this was the most important thing in the world.
Right.
So I met up with some friends from my old job yesterday.
And that sounds hyperbolic, but...
Yeah, but like, yeah, you don't blink though when I say that. You're like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For like, sure. So,
you know, like everybody, if you go to a bush bash or something, everyone's like, oh yeah, 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 mm. Most important thing in the world. That's how I felt as well. But it was, you know, I was talking to friends yesterday and they were just like, oh, so what's going on with all the crypto stuff, and it's like Bitcoin. Okay, what's going on with Bitcoin? And it's like, yes, it's good or good. Like, it's obviously a lot of fraud getting flushed out of the system at the moment, but pretty good long term. It's like, so you don't think there's, is there anything else that's good apart from Bitcoin? Nothing. It's like, oh, it's like not even Ethereum, especially not Ethereum. It's bullshit. It won't be here in 5 years. Done. And just like, oh, right. So should I sell Ethereum and just buy Bitcoin? It's like, yes. Mm-hmm. I feel like now I've kind of lost all nuance in those conversations. I'm like, yeah, that's, you don't listen to any of the arguments there. So like, yes, that's the facts. Now, here's a word, sound money. Hopefully that'll work on you as well. But,
yeah, ring that bell in your head for a moment, the concept of sound money. I mean, you kind of get to a point, I think, as a Bitcoiner where, yes, you just become obsessed by this thing. Mm-hmm. And you want to understand it as best you can and constantly humble yourself before it and before other people that are a little bit further down that rabbit hole that may have something to teach you.
Yeah.
Or maybe, and whether that's good or bad, you know, you've got certain individuals within the space that can teach you ways not to think because they're just a complete scam artist, and others that are like, that's quite thoughtful. And it's like a take what works, leave what doesn't type of vibe.
I think there's like another angle to it as well, which is, it's not necessarily a Bitcoin change, but it is, it's kind of like Bitcoin adjacent in a way, which I was like trying to do a little bit of thinking around, you know, like moral philosophy and like, what do I believe in and how do I think I could lead a good life and things like that. And I did end up getting down to the point of, so the previous work I was doing was like in this payment app with the charity attached to it and the impact stuff. And so I was dealing a lot with charities, like not-for-profits, NGOs, like the UN, various people. And it felt like very like worthy about stuff. And I you start to realize just like how, again, like how much nonsense there is in that world, and how people don't necessarily want to solve the problems that you think they want to solve, or, you know, like the just level of bureaucracy and shit that destroys the value of the funds that eventually do get donated, and how efficient all that was. And that kind of maybe pulled back the curtain a little bit on thinking like, oh, I used to have this view that like that was good. Like, it's probably been like drilled in from being a kid, was, you know, like a not-for-profit means it's good. Mm-hmm. And therefore the other version is bad. Whereas in that sort of like social impact space, there's a lot of people that would talk about it and go, like, it's bad framing, you know, shouldn't be thinking like that. Cause it's like saying, all right, well, I give to this charity, so now I can be as evil as I want. It's like, we could just be good. Like, what's wrong with that? Like, just have good businesses. Like, let's just not be pricks about stuff. Like, that would be a nice world. I assume swearing is fine.
Oh, I like that tagline. Yeah, I think right. I look forward to the next charity being opened up. Whatever it is, and then just not pricks, not be pricks. Sort of a Google don't be evil type sort of spin-off.
Don't be a cunt. It'd be very Aussie.
You're 100% correct, though, because you do join certain industries or fields or environments where you come in with a fairly idealistic view. You think they're inherently doing good things. They're not for profit, they're this, they're that, and all the rest of it. And then when you get into the nitty gritty and into the trenches and you start to see the seedy underbelly, you think, wow, like everyone is literally just scamming for more and more money. And they're doing it with this veil of, and I can't even think of the word, but it's just this highfalutin, I don't know, it just kind of reminds me of sort of like, housewives, you know, what are they, not what's that show, Real Housewives sort of thing. Like, it's just this smarmy, look at how wonderful I'm doing, and they wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't for the social capital that they were getting. You know,
I don't think it's necessarily true of all charities necessarily, but you realize how much more widespread it is, and it just sort of, I think it just, like, as I say, it peels back the curtain a little bit, and you go, oh yeah, that's a weird, it's weird that I thought that. So I wonder like where that goes. And then that was over, it's pretty similar times that I was discovering Bitcoin, and I was, independent of that, just reading a bit more around like anarchist thoughts and tendencies. And so I was like, okay, yeah, I feel like I'm at home with the idea that you're not necessarily good just because you're in government, not just because you're in charity. So that's fine. I feel like I'm probably more on like the anarchist part of the scale. I have no particular like right left leanings. I don't think. I have tendencies. I like all the stuff that people on the left want. It's just, I think, don't force anybody to give it to them. So, to me, like, I feel like my predominant philosophy then just comes down to, all right, it's about strong local communities is what we need. To get back to that. Like, that's the thing that I think most people can agree with. If you turn up and go, oh, you know, I'm an anarchist, everybody starts saying that you would be the first to be killed, or, oh, well, what if I just beat you up and take all your stuff? And you're like, well, you won't, because of social norms. Like, you know, all of the people in this group here would think you're a cunt if you did that, and you won't do it. That's why you don't do it. It's not because there's a copper 10Ks away. He'll come and ask me some questions tomorrow. That doesn't really factor into it.
And if it does factor into your decision making to be a cunt, then you are genuinely legitimately a cunt. So, you know, I mean, when you go down that sort of libertarian anarcho-capitalist rabbit hole, it is a bit confronting, particularly coming from maybe a world that you've never really been exposed to before Bitcoin. And it's like this constant defragging of your brain where all of these concepts are getting chipped away, and well, that's actually incorrect if you think about it like this. And then when you read something like a Mises or a Rothbard or a Hopper, you think that sounds so brutal and yet so truthful. right? And yeah, that whole non-aggression principle concept. And I mean, I on the left-right divide, I completely done away with that. Having read an essay, and I can't remember who wrote it, but voluntarism versus coercion. Those are the two spectrums.
Yeah. It's the thing that's worth arguing about, right? Like if we all want to like get together and help other people and that's how we're defining this thing, it's like, great, just do it. Like, but
that's right.
Maybe we shouldn't force these people to do it if they don't want to. That's fine. We don't have to associate it.
Yeah, and it's such a basic thing. It's, in fact, it's probably taught to most children, like as kids, we're taught these fundamentals, and yet they get sort of obfuscated, co-opted, whatever, as you get older into you're not a very good person unless you do this because I'm doing it because I'm so wonderful and thinking about everybody else because that's the reason I'm doing it. Yeah. So it does change your mindset a little bit, and then it actually disables you to interact in normal everyday circumstances, which is hard, you know.
I don't know. Like, I think that's where you can go back to just going, oh, wouldn't it be great if we had like good, strong communities? It's like, yeah, I'm not like a religious person, but like I've always said that I think we lost something like in the moment that we took religion out of society and we all stopped going to this like one big room in the middle of the village every week and. You know, you would be eyeballing everybody around the room and like one guy doesn't look very good and you're like, oh shit, what's up with Bill? And then everybody checks in with Bill and provides him some help if that's what he needs. Like all that stuff sort of went away and everybody's like fragmented off into their own little castles and they just stare at the telly and nobody talks to each other. You know, it feels like you could still have the gathering. So, and I feel like whenever anything like that happens, like if you go to like a, you know, like a men's group or something like that, or you have the men's sheds over here where people go and do woodwork and stuff and like anything where you get people together, everybody really loves it. And there's clearly, like, I think people go, oh shit, this is what that hole was. Like, it's just like being amongst other people. I've stopped doing it and I've stopped like, you know, being honest with people. I'm just sort of sat at home pretending everything's okay. So I think that community, I really think it's the thing that's missing.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. A strong community. I mean, there's a market I go to once a fortnight, and I love going down there to the storeholders and getting the produce, you know, and seeing them. And that's a whole, well, relatively new cliche nowadays, with amongst Bitcoiners, is shake your rancher or shake your farmer's hand. But there is something to that. You know, I was reading James C. Scott. I've got the book Seeing Like a State. And he has a section in there that talks about how communities, particularly in old Europe, they almost had this sort of organic neighborhood watch program where it wasn't sort of rectified in any way. It was just by being in the town square or having an apartment up above in the plaza or something, you get to see familiar faces each and every day. You see the patterns emerge, and then as you become accustomed to the space and to the local area, you become an individual in there that people are looking out for at this particular time. They're usually in this spot. And then when things aren't quite aligned, maybe one day you're not in that particular spot that you've always been, or you see someone else that's not there, then you can start asking questions. Are they okay? Do you know? And that's that whole community that's just an organic emergent phenomenon, as opposed to this outsourcing that we've done, as you were sort of alluding to before, where we just think someone else could take care of that, you know, a social services or a police officer or something to that effect.
It's such nonsense, right? Like, what's the chance that person is even going to notice, never mind, will care?
Yeah, because their incentives are completely misaligned because they don't actually understand the territory. Their map on their clipboard is just completely... completely wrong relative to the territory that they're trying to operate within, you know. So it's interesting. So you've thought a little bit more about community and you think that there's a little bit more of a – Bitcoin has enabled you to identify that and
– I think I was thinking that anyway, but it maybe like tracks to like what I'm interested in Bitcoin now as well, right, because I'm – obviously working at Fedi, it's all about community Bitcoin, not self-sovereign Bitcoin. You know, we're all, that said, like, I mean, everybody at Fedi like holds all their own keys, has all their own backups and all the rest of it, and we love all that. But there is this notion that, like, look, there's a space between, you know, like, everybody gives all their money to some prick in the Bahamas and he steals it, to like, everybody has to hold all of their own money themselves, otherwise you're not to compete. It's like, well, how do you bring on this, like, you know, there's 10,000 people, but only 50 of them know anything about Bitcoin in this community. And you go, all right, well, that's fine. 10 of those 50 could run this for everybody else to use. And then everybody gets to use Bitcoin and the money stays in the community. Like, it doesn't piss off somewhere else. Like, it's in that community. And I think we, because we've lost a lot of the community over here, I think that seems weirder to a lot of, like, Western Bitcoiners versus, like, when we talk about this over in, like, at the Africa Bitcoin Conference, people get it. They're used to trusting local community organizations with money, with insurance stuff, like, with banking, because they don't have large banking institutions that they can trust. Or large insurance institutions that they could trust. So there's more of a commonality, I think, in other places in the world to actually lean on your community in that way. So I think that's kind of interesting because it's just such a nicer, more scalable way of doing things, I think, in my mind. It's like, let's go, instead of orange pilling, you know, 100,000 people, let's orange pill 10 that bring along 100,000 people, and then we're going to get there quicker. We get all that money off exchanges and then let's build on top of that.
Yeah, that's the trade-off, right? So in order for this to sort of, as that gap, I think, you know, as Western Bitcoiners that have become aware, they've always intuited maybe this sense of personal responsibility and accountability, but now you can kind of couch it in a physical action of holding your own keys and doing the work that's required to ensure the security of your wealth and your family's wealth into the future. So we've sort of taken to that idea of personal responsibility. And then when you come along with something like Fedi, it kind of doesn't align with that extreme personal responsibility. And it's almost looks like it's going in the other direction, but it's kind of not. Actually, it's just, as you said, it's a way to scale it to those people that,
yeah, it's like being a service provider. Like, you know, if you're the one that's taking on a personal responsibility, it's, and I think we all go here as well with Bitcoin, right? You take on that responsibility and you become like your own man, your own bank, and the rest of it, and then you start to worry about everybody else. You go, fuck, like, how am I going to get them on? And usually what actually happens is you end up holding like your family's Bitcoin or something because they don't quite get it. You don't want them leaving it on an exchange. So you go, all right, well, I'll look after it for you. And here's a way that you can get it if anything happens to me. And that's remarkably common that people will hold their, you know, like mum, dad's Bitcoin, like something for the brother or sister or something like that. And then right there, you've got the makings of like a little community there. That's exactly what it is all right, well, I'm already holding it for my family. You're doing it for your family. You're doing it for yours. But they can't do anything with that. It's just stuffed away in my cold storage because that's the easiest way of doing it than like giving them a Lightning wallet on top of it or something. Whereas with something like Fedi, you can get together with a bunch of mates and go, all right, well, we're the guys in this community that know how to do it. Let's do it for the broader community. You're just extending that sort of caring out a little bit wider into, okay, well, your friends are friends of friends and my friends are friends of friends. And now we've got 10,000 people that we could look after and we know we're not going to take it because that's not what we're about. And you're kind of there, you have that community thing can pop up and then it's an easier place for those people to store some Bitcoin. And it means that, you know, you see like a lot of these communities that are popping up all over the place. So you have like Lago Bitcoin over in Guatemala. There's like one in the northeast of Brazil, like Praia Bitcoin. You got obviously Bitcoin Akazi down in South Africa. There's a whole bunch throughout sort of Zambia, Nigeria, and other places. And that a lot of the times, like what you see is that they'll predominantly use things like the wallet of Satoshi, or it'll be like the Bitcoin Beach wallet. And you say, you ask the question, you know, how, so if we're onboarding everybody into like Bitcoin Beach, that's good. And it's a trusted wallet and stuff. But right now, like I said, have you set up your own sort of Bitcoin Beach infrastructure? And they say, oh, no, it's a bit beyond what we're able to do locally. And so you say, oh, okay, so you're using basically the same version that they're using in El Salvador. And say, yes. So, okay, so you're aware that like your money is in El Salvador. Basically, it's not in the community, and they're like, "Yeah, that's why we reached out." Like, it's like we want the money in the community, not elsewhere. Like, similarly with Wallet of Satoshi, they're like, "Yeah, it's great, it's simple, it really does the job, and everybody likes using it." But it is a worry that the money's over there. It's like, oh yeah, it's like over in Queensland. It's not in your community. Hmm. So now you're kind of like it's easy to not realize because you say, oh, okay, well, I've got a machine and it's got keys on it or whatever. But you're like, nah, it's all over there. It's all held like in Australia. An Australian legal system doesn't have the best record of respecting, like, you know, open source or cryptography. Like, they're fucking terrible.
No.
So it's, yeah, like, I think that idea of like, well, what you want is the community can run its own Bitcoin. And then the money in the Bitcoin is in the community. And if somebody does something wrong in that community, they're probably just going to get punched in the face and exiled from the community. Like, we have hundreds and thousands of years of dealing with people that do wrong by their community. I think there's good reasons why people don't generally do that.
Without a doubt. There's a lot of, I mean, perhaps not so much in the countries that Fedi is probably going to take off first, but as you were alluding to before, in the Western Hemisphere, there's a lot of frictions from trust and establishing that sense of trust. I mean, yeah. I could be the guy in my community that says, yeah, look, I'll hold your old keys, and then just like, cool, man, but you're the crazy Bitcoiner that, you know, I get it. You've been shouting it from the rooftops. Every chance you get, but we still don't know who you are. We don't trust you, right? And the speed of trust is quite slow at the moment. So that creates all of these frictions. So, yeah.
I mean, this is one of the reasons why, because it doesn't make anything easier to go and target like rural Africa, right? Like you're going into a world now where you're like, all right, well, there's not like a massively well deployed mobile like smartphone networks. There's not great internet in many places. There's not necessarily great power. Yeah, like you're not making your life easy, but we're going there. And we're going there because the other thing we need is the trust. Like, you know, we need the second party trust. These trust networks need to exist for something like this is where it's going to take off. Mm-hmm. And that's what it has. It has that approach. And there's a need as well, right? You know, it's people only adopt tools where it solves a problem. So the idea is to go there with a tool that can help solve problems, you know, and many of these countries, like, it is hard to just securely hold money.
Mm. So it is a nascent technology that you guys are, that you're working on, in terms of its protocol layers. And I mean, I noticed there was a little bit of pushback, at the conference a few weeks ago with respect to Charming eCash and, threats of rehypothecation and so on and so forth, which is all valid and fair. How does it sort of mitigate that in a, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the main, so just to put it like for anybody, if anybody's listening, is curious, like if you go to the fedimint.org website, so there's I work for Fedi, which is a company that's building on top of protocol called Fedimint, which is separate, and that's like the open source protocol. So my initial intro into the whole space was I wrote all the documentation on the fedimint.org site to explain how it all works. And if you get into there, there's like a section on trade-offs. The section on trade-offs is, I think, as long as the section on how it works. So we did quite a bit of work in trying to adequately describe the different attacks you could have on a Fedimint and how they would play out and how you would benefit from them and so on. So people could understand the risks quite greatly. So it's worth having a look there for that. Now the two big ones that that come up consistently with Fedimins is that you effectively hand over the custody of your Bitcoin to somebody else, right? And this is a truth that all Bitcoin is always custodied in one place or another, right? And then being rampant, you know, laser-eyed Bitcoiners, for us, it's like, it's my Bitcoin, and I hold it here. Like, most people in the world, like, don't hold Bitcoin, so they won't be giving up custody into this. They'll probably earn in something like this, and it will always be inside of Fedimins. So the other place is that you've got, like, exchanges and some sort of third party. And so generally our view is that what we're trying to do is not to get a bunch of long-term Bitcoiners to give up custody and put it into community custody. It's to get a bunch of communities on and not go into exchanges or to come out of exchanges into community custody. And so when you look at something like the risk of rehypothecation, so the issue that you've got here is with something like Charmian eCash, it's a perfectly private system for holding money inside what you could think of as like a community bank. But because it's private, we can't verify who's got what. And we actually don't know. That's part of the privacy guarantee of the thing. And so you've got this sort of bank where we know how much Bitcoin is in the bank, but we don't know how many eCash notes have been issued with claims on the Bitcoin inside that bank. And it's only when it gets spent and then reclaimed from the mint that you find out whether the mint's there. Now, compared to an exchange, as we already see right now, that already exists. So you already have that problem with the exchange, which is usually like we're trying to pull people away from the exchanges and into these more community-based setups. So you could say it's probably better on the face of it in that sense, because now at least we know how many Bitcoin are in this multi-sig, and people can, you know, we can do some on-app monitoring in the Fedi app around, like, you know, what's your share of the Bitcoin versus what we can see in the on-chain multi-sig and things like this. We can alert on excessive flows going out by the Lightning Network and these things. But there's always going to be that risk. So some of the ways that we've looked at solving that are going to be things like programmatic bank runs. So in the same way that, you know, there is no proof of reserves, like, because at best it's a point in time snapshot. The reality is the only one that really matters is when you pull the keys into your own custody, or is the movement of the funds is what shows that the funds are there. And the movement of all the funds in one go is the thing that's going to, the only thing. So what we've been looking at is ways where you could have multiple different federations, because again, these Fedimins are actually quite lightweight to spin up and run. It's a bit simpler than running a Lightning node. So just as an idea. And so could you have like a Federation A, and then you spin up Federation B in the same community, and then you bank run from A to B and reissue all the coins inside the new system? And then what you find is, do we reissue the same amount of note back inside this new system and match that? And all of a sudden now we've got a point in time snapshot of how that works. I mean, there's other ways that are being looked at for, like, in the space of like zero knowledge proofs and state chain based holding of the funds in the multisig and in the Fedimin as well, for trying to map the claims to the users. But it's a tricky space, because it's trying to get that trade-off between the privacy and the auditability. And so, yeah, I don't think there's a perfect solution to it as a problem. But
no, but as Wiz said, there's no solutions. There's just trade-offs. And being aware of those trade-offs is probably the first step.
Yeah, and I think we'd say, look, our goal is to take... is to create more people that don't have Bitcoin on exchanges.
Yeah.
And it's a really good way of doing that. And again, there's a huge difference between aggregating all money into one large exchange in Coinbase versus allowing 10 million communities to hold their own money.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you're sort of aggregating to a slightly different point where it's not the company, it's not the individual always that has that knowledge of the funds and they've withdrawn to. It's the group of guardians that are protecting it. Mm-hmm. So I mean, to me, I think the trade-offs are worth it in some circumstances.
Well, it seems to incentivize that concept of community and bringing that back as well, because you've got skin in the game. You know the people that you're interacting with, that you're transacting with, and like there'll be error correction over time where certain communities may fail and others will flourish.
Yeah.
But that's part and parcel of life. So, you know.
Yeah. And this is the grand unknown that we don't know, right? It's like, well, what all we're doing is we're writing up like an open source protocol for how you would do this for communities. Like, you know, so you can run them, but it doesn't tell you how big the community is, how many guardians they are, who those guardians are, like what other controls they put in place as guardians to make sure that nothing's going wrong. Like, it's, that's all wide open, like, and deliberately so, because it's not really the scope of like an open source protocol to define that. It should just do the minimal amount it needs to do, which is the holding of the funds, the keeping it safe, the issuing of the assets. And then you allow people to experiment on top of that. And like, let's find out. There's been a bit of conversation in the Telegram chat this week where a few people were saying, you know, obviously you'd want, like, you know, you'd probably want to be in like a 17 of 21 Guardian Fediment. And I was like, why? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it's trust is harder for them to collude. And you say, but I'd rather be in, I don't know, like a 3 of 5 where I know the 5, like, whereas a lot of people kind of come at this and go, I mean, the first thing is people look at it and go, oh, like there's one Fediment. And they don't realize that the idea is that there will be like literally millions of these things, like many we don't even know. And they'll all have different approaches to things. And they might all optimize for different things. It's really quite an open like platform for running federated applications. You can build all sorts on it. And I think we will see a lot of modules springing up that take advantage of that. And then once you realize that there's not one and there's going to be millions, and you think, all right, well, people start to go, okay, well, maybe it'll be a couple of exchanges run them because that's the way Liquid's deployed. And you say, yeah, maybe, but I don't know. I don't think so. But I think you're more likely to trust somebody that's local to you where you've already got a network. So I think what you will see is that these start to crop up around existing trust networks.
Mm-hmm.
And so something that might sound weird is like, well, maybe it's your employer runs one. You say, well, I don't know if I trust my employer, but you do because you work all month for them before they pay you. So you're already in their debt in a way anyway. So what's wrong with like your employer running localized Fediment so that they can run a simpler payment transaction system, which, you know, again, in the West, you think, oh, I don't know if that's useful. But if I'm, you know, if I'm in rural Africa and I want to earn some money, then there are ways that I can earn money online, except for the fact that I can't get paid because I have no bank account. And it's an honest problem. So it's like, how do you do like the last? So then people say, okay, well, we'll just send Bitcoin, but then, okay, well, maybe I don't have a means of using Bitcoin in my local community. So what do I do next? So the Fedi approach to stuff like this is, you know, it's a community. So as soon as you bring the concept of a community into an app, all of a sudden you've got more options because there's multiple people in that community. Some of these people might be peer-to-peer traders, for instance. So now all of a sudden the person that's getting the money in is in the same community as a peer-to-peer trader, and they can just do last mile locally in the community by saying, all right, can I sell my Bitcoin for Kenyan shillings? And now all of a sudden that in the same app, you can just get your remittance or your payment in Bitcoin and clear it to Kenyan shillings within 10 minutes. And there you've got like a nice pragmatic solution to a real problem. Like, how do I go to the last mile?
Yeah. I mean, so there's infinite variabilities for something like this. And I guess as human beings, when we first encounter a problem, we try and maybe overthink it or think of 17 of 21 and that sort of thing. I can think of like families, you know, as Bitcoiners, they talk about legacy and building strong names into the future, and you know, you could almost have a federation for your family, and if you're the patriarch, the matriarch of the family, and you could have it distributed amongst your brothers and sisters or aunts, uncles, whatever the case is, grandparents, etc. You know, and
yeah, then, like aunties, uncles, like, I mean, families get pretty big pretty quick if you include in them, right?
There's so much scope. Okay. What have you learned about the world and about yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
Learned about the world. I think these days I find it hard not to look at the world and see a lot of corruption and nonsense. That's unfortunate, because it's not an ideal way. It's not a very happy-go-lucky way to live, to just suddenly be aware of quite how much corruption and nonsense there is. But again, I think this is one of the reasons that just spurred me into just realizing that I can't not work in Bitcoin. So my path was very much that I decided I wasn't going to work any longer in the corporate sector, and I just left and said, right, let's find out what I can do in Bitcoin and started trying to be useful to people. So I think, yeah, that it's like I felt like I was looking at the world and realizing that I didn't like what I saw, and that I suspected I might be on the wrong side of what is potentially like the most important battle that's going to get fought for the next 5 years. And so I just walked away and got on the other side. So it was, yeah, I think it was this notion of like, I think we had about a year ago, I said, I think it's probably about 5 years in which we have to have the fight for Bitcoin. And it might be quicker than that, the way it's shaping up at the moment. And it really is this fight between large central aggregated power structures in all their forms. You know, like I'm not a fan of the state. I'm not necessarily a fan of very large businesses either that act like a quasi-state. The problem of all of these things is just you put too much power into too few hands. And the thing that we're supposed to decentralize is the power. It's not about numbers of nodes. It's not about, you know, who's running what. It's about the power and your ability to interact with the thing is what we're decentralizing. So... yeah, so I think that's probably the biggest impact on how I see the world myself. Was it just, yeah, it's very much like a veil coming off. I was thinking, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't necessarily want to have to change everything about my life, but if I'm going to be consistent with my morals and how I view things, then I need to go and fight for Bitcoin. So
nice. Yeah. Okay, how do you explain Bitcoin to someone when you're talking to your friends before and they keep mentioning crypto or whatever? You know, how do you go about orange pilling someone?
I think I kind of like touched on a little bit earlier. I don't think you can orange pill people. So I find the best way that I think I can do it is to just be quite steadfast in my own example of, you know, so if you've got a friend who's just constantly buying Bitcoin, you say, like, you're still buying Bitcoin? It's gone down a lot. And you're like, oh yeah, I'm buying more Bitcoin. Like, oh right, that's interesting. I wonder why he's doing that. And you say, like, oh, what about this? And you go, that shit. What about this? That shit. And if you're quite consistent, then I think people pick up, like, okay, well, he really believes in this. And there's something there. Like, ask him, like, what you think is the most important thing in the world is. It's just Bitcoin straight away. And then I talk to his kids, and his kids are talking about Bitcoin. It's like, and it, I think that rubs off on people, and they go, well, I might just dip my toe in and see. And that's like, so most of my friends that have adopted it have done it, like, just like that. I just get like a message out of the blue one day, and they go, so I just bought X amount of Bitcoin. What do I do next? And I'll be like, oh, cool. Go and get yourself a hardware wallet, and I can help you, and, you know, like, you'll need these words to get them safe somewhere, and then tell your wife if anything happens, I'll help you out. But it's usually happened like that, I think. It's been by example. And then if it comes down to, like, what I would say, I applied to a tweet on this the other day, it's like, I think you just got to describe it for what it is and try and, like, leave some sort of question. And so I like to just describe Bitcoin as just being an honest money in a world that needs a little bit more honesty. And I think there's something there that people start to wonder. It's like, well, you know, again, you play the negative game and you go, well, yeah, I mean, I want honest money. I don't want dishonest money. That's terrible. Well, am I using dishonest money? My God. Hopefully people will catch out and ask themselves a little bit more about what that means. And then you can deal with the questions. But I was talking to a friend I've known for a little while the other day. He's got a job where he manages this co-living space that's cropped up in Perth. It's got like about 500 people living in this space, and then they have like shared working environments, and they have like shared like rooftop terraces and pool tables and like a little nightclub up on the roof with all this. So it looks very swish, and they do like meetings and like they talk about various things and skills. And he said, everyone keeps asking about Bitcoin. I said, can you come in and talk to them about Bitcoin? I was like, yes. I suspect they might have asked about cryptocurrencies, but they're certainly not going to hear about cryptocurrencies. hear about Bitcoin. And I sort of said to him, like, look, I think the way to approach this is, let's do like free sessions over the course of a few months. I'll get the local Bitcoin meetup guys, and we'll all come down. Like, we'll get the Perth Heat guy in here, and he can tell you about running it in a business. And let's just ask questions, lots of field questions. We'll give like a brief 5 minutes about why it's interesting, where we try and throw a couple of those hooks out there. But then we'll just deal with all the questions. Because when you try and tell people about it, and I did do this actually with a bunch of sort of close friends and people that I felt would really benefit from Bitcoin. I invited them all over, set this meeting room, put the wine on, got some food in, and like led them through like why I think Bitcoin is interesting. And I basically gave, like, without stopping to talk, about an hour and a half run through of why I thought it was interesting. It was all based on this model of, you know, like, here's my little boy and he's got this plan. And the plan in the future is that he wants to save the animals. It's what he cares most about in the world, right? And so the task that I set him was, well, how are you going to do that? And he's like, I don't know. And I said, well, what if we buy the rainforest? And it's like, all right, can I buy the rainforest? I said, you'll probably buy some of it. How are we going to do that? And he's like, okay, I'm going to buy the rainforest, right? We're going to make some money. I was like, okay, how are you going to make some money? I'm going to write some books, and I'll YouTube about Minecraft. And it's like, okay, cool. Whatever, some ideas about that. And we say, but how are you going to, it's going to take you a while to save up for this, Mike. How are we going to do this? How are you going to keep your money? And then I'd, like, with all the people in the room, not with my 8-year-old, but we'd go through like the various risks. Like, why are the reasons why it's going to be really hard for this kid to start earning money now and putting it away for 20 years so that he can buy the rainforest to save the animals, sort of thing. And I use that framework to talk about like the political risk of seizure and like inflation and technical risks and various like risk-based framework I had for why I thought Bitcoin was the only thing that matters. And I didn't stop talking for an hour and a half. I think I lost a bunch of people along the way because there was a set of assumed knowledge you needed. And then we stopped, took a glass of wine. I sat down in the circle with everybody. And then the questions came for like another 2 hours on top of that. And like all the value was in the questions.
Yeah.
And I finished it and I was like, okay, next time, don't bother.
Yeah.
Stop trying to be clever with it. Just engage people where they're at with questions in a nice environment.
Yeah, that's true. It's like you were saying, like Leonard Reed's, I think it's One Improved Unit. There's a video on YouTube, you can look it up, but it's that light in the dark, and that you just lead by example, and that those people that are attuned to what it is that you're doing and are curious enough to ask and perhaps then dip the toe and follow that sort of follow your lead, as it were, through asking questions, and provided that, you know, clearly none of us have all the answers, but we can certainly, it's always funny to me when you try and orange pill someone, you are coming at it from a place of compassion rather than, you know, anything else really. And you do get a lot of pushback. And so then it leads to a little bit of like, I'm trying to help you here. Like, all right, fuck off then. Don't worry about it. Well, Pete, I just wanted to say thanks for sharing your time and energy with us today. It's such a cool story. Everyone's got an origin story, a genesis story, and how they discovered Bitcoin. And it is relatively universal, but there are some individual nuances that are really fun to unpack. And I've had a lot of fun chatting with you about that today. Tell us a little bit about where people can find you, maybe connect, learn a little bit more about Fedi, the protocol Fediments, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, cool. I always forget what my Twitter name is. I was going to look it up. So if anyone's interested in Fedi and Fedi Mints, right? So Fedi Mints, the protocol, you do whatever you want with this. Go to fedimint.org. Feel free to have a look through the documentation. Spend quite a bit of time on it, so I'd appreciate it. Yeah. If you have any questions, ask them in the Telegram chat. It's probably the best way. Fedi.xyz is the website for that. So that's the business that I'm part of, and we're building using Fedi Mints as like a base protocol for custody. So it's going to be very interesting. We'll be making a whole bunch of announcements over the course of early next year. So
nice.
Keep watching out for that. I think it's Fedi BTC on Twitter.
Okay.
And then my Twitter is Pete. So PETE _ Win WINN. So yeah, feel free to reach out, ask questions. I think DMs are open. I don't always see, for some reason, Twitter never shows me notifications, which is sort of fine. Like, keeps the noise level.
It's good. It's a good thing.
Yeah, I'm always up for a chat. So.
No, it's been awesome, man. Time and energy sharing it with me. Thank you very much. And I look forward to connecting again somewhere down the track.
Yeah, no worries. Just...